call to order the this meeting of the Commerce Committee. We do have a quorum. Our first item of business is approval of our minutes from March 22nd. Representative Katisa Watune.
Mr. Chair, I would move approval of the March 22nd minutes.
Representative Katisa Watune moves approval of our minutes from March 22nd, 2023. Discussion to the motion. Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Today, members, we will begin the first of a two-part process of examining our budget bill for 2023, or for this year, excuse me. What we are going to do today is have nonpartisan staff walk through the bill, first the fiscal components and then the policy components. We will then take testimony from the public on the bill. If we have time remaining, we will allow for member questions at the end of that. We will return on Wednesday for markup discussion and a vote on the bill. Is there any questions about that process? Seeing none, I will first recognize Ms. Eng to discuss the fiscal component of the bill.
Mr. Chair and members, Ashley Eng, House Fiscal. Looking at the spreadsheet, we'll start with line two, general fund spending. There is $31,733,000 in fiscal year 24 for all agencies, $261,972,000 in fiscal year 25, $32,077,000 in fiscal year 26, $32,107,000 in fiscal year 27. Looking at revenue on line six, there is a $12,000 deposit in for Money Transmission Modernization Act in fiscal year 24. On line seven, there is a transfer in from the premium security account of $275,775,000 in fiscal year 26. There is $38,000 in fiscal year 24, $78,000 in fiscal year 25 and ongoing from the telecommunications assessment. There is a deposit from the special revenue account to the general fund for the Minnesota Council on Economic Education of $100,000 in fiscal year 24. There is $73,000 in ongoing revenue from the excessive price increases to generic drug prohibition. And there is $484,000 ongoing, starting in fiscal year 24, for fee modernization. The net general fund impact is $31,038,000 in fiscal year 24, $261,337,000 in fiscal year 25, general fund savings of $244,333,000 in fiscal year 26, and a cost of $31,472,000 in fiscal year 27. Lines 18 through 20 summarize the fund impact for the Department of Commerce. Looking at line 22, starting with the Financial Institutions Division, there is $2,569,000 in fiscal year 24, $2,689,000 in fiscal year 25, $2,689,000 in fiscal year 26 and 27. This includes the operating increase and the student loan advocate. There is that Money Transmission Modernization Act revenue through the increased assessment authority. On line 34, for the Administrative Services Division, there is $10,076,000 in fiscal year 24, $10,102,000 in fiscal year 25, $9,915,000 in fiscal year 26 and 27. This includes the operating increase, the Senior Safe Fraud Prevention Program, excessive price increases to generic drug prohibition, Exodus lending grants. And on line 47 for the Enforcement and Market Assurance Division, there is $7,185,000 in fiscal year 24, $7,473,000 fiscal year 25, $7,548,000 in fiscal year 26 and 27, which includes general fund and workers' compensation fund. From the general fund, that includes the operating increase, Commerce Fraud Bureau body-worn cameras, and the Substance Abuse Accountability Office. Additionally, there is the operating increase from the Workers' Compensation Fund on line 68 and the transfer to the general fund from the consumer education account for the Minnesota Council on Economic Education on line 71. For the telecommunications division on line 73, there is $3,221,000 in fiscal year 24, $3,261,000 on fiscal year 25, $3,261,000 in 26 and 27, which includes the general fund and telecommunications access fund. That includes line 80, the operating increase, and there is also the transfer to the general fund from the telecommunications assessment. On line 91, the insurance division, there is $9,172,000 in fiscal year 24, $9,592,000 in fiscal year 25, $9,274,000 in fiscal year 26, and $9,304,000 in fiscal year 27. This includes the general fund and workers' compensation fund. And for the general fund, it includes the operating increase, the standardized plans, free primary care study, staffing and operations, the psychiatric collaborative care model covered, and evaluation of existing statutory health mandates, as well as an operating increase from the Workers' Compensation Fund. Looking at reinsurance, there is $229,465,000 transfer to the premium security account in fiscal year 25, and on line 129, there is a $275,775,000 transfer out of the premium security account to the general fund in fiscal year 26. In the weights and measures division, there is $1,531,000 in fiscal year 24, $1,556,000 in fiscal year 25, $1,556,000 in 26 and 27, which includes the operating increase. Down on lines 136, there is $691,000 in fiscal year 24, and ongoing to the Attorney General, there is on 141, there is $69,000 in fiscal year 24, and $51,000 in fiscal year 25, and ongoing to the Health Department for excessive price increases to generic drug prohibition. And finally, to the Education Department, there is the $100,000, which is a transfer from the Special Revenue Account for the Minnesota Council on Economic Education. That concludes my presentation.
Thank you. Next, we will hear from Ms. Pompu. Ms. Pompu.
Chair and members, we're going to start with Article 2 on page 8.
And actually, Ms. Pompu, before we continue, I do want to tell members that it's our intention to use the same printouts of your spreadsheet and your DE on Wednesday. You're not getting another copy, so please leave those here when you leave today so that staff can bring them back on Wednesday. Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, we're in the DE, right?
We are now going to be discussing the DE, yes. Ms. Pompu.
Chair and members, so this is Article 2, Section 1. Section 1 allows the Commissioner of Management and Budget to exclude coverage for psychiatric residential treatment facilities for members of the State Employee Group Insurance Program. Section 2 relates to boat, umbrella, and personal liability, and includes the prohibition against household or family exclusions from coverage. Section 3 raises certain fees relating to insurance companies. And then we're on to page 11. Sections 4 and 5 relate to the ability of life insurance to not allow a death benefit if an insured completes suicide within 1 year of issuance of the policy. On to page 13, Section 6. Section 6 prohibits insurers from discriminating against hospital or psychiatric residential treatment facilities. We're providing direct reimbursements. On to section 7 to 15, these relate to Medicare supplemental plans. And they create an open enrollment period for Medicare supplemental plans that aligns with the Medicare Advantage enrollment period. And they prohibit medical underwriting or the use of pre-existing condition limitations in Medicare supplemental policies. So, let's see, 15. Okay. On to page 25. Sections 16 to 20 relate to clarifying the definition of preventive services. Under current law, there are cross-references just to the Affordable Care Act. These changes bring in language from the federal regulations and more extensively define what a preventive service is. On to page 26, sections 21 and 22 relate to health mandate benefit proposals. Section 21 provides that the definition of mandated health benefit proposal does not include when the law will make changes to state law to make it compliant with federal law. And section 22, which the pertinent provision begins on page 28, requires the Commissioner of Commerce to provide the public with 45 days notice when they're going to be requesting information related to a health mandate benefit proposal. And it clarifies that information that is trade secret is non-public data. On page 28, beginning on section 23 to section 39, this prohibits excessive price increases of generic drugs and creates the Prescription Drug Affordability Board. And that goes all the way to page 42. On page 42, sections 40 to 42, again, require coverage of psychiatric residential treatment facilities for insurers and HMOs. That goes until page 46. On page 46, we have another definition relating to preventive items and services. And this would be sections 43, 44, and 46. Oh, section 46 also includes requirements relating to the psychiatric collaborative care model and requiring insurers to cover that as part of their coverage package. On page 47, section 45 creates the Mental Health Parity and Substance Abuse Accountability Office within the Department of Commerce. We've already discussed section 46. So we're on to page 52. Page 52, sections 48 to 52 relate to contracts between dental organizations and dentists. Disclosures that must happen, making a manner of fee payment making a manner of payment in between those parties without fees. And that goes to page 55. Page 55, section 54, relates to individual health insurance. And this requires health plan companies to offer each type of metal level of individual health insurance within the geographic regions that they operate in. It requires the Commissioner of Commerce to annually work with the Commissioner of Health regarding setting parameters for these standard policies. On to page 56, section 55, clinician-administered drugs. This bill relates to private insurance and requirements relating to cost sharing and reimbursement for clinician-administered drugs and allowing for enrollee choice. On to page 58, section 56 relates to homeowners insurance and requires insurers when a person builds a new property that meets the fortified program standards from the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety, or if they modify an existing property to meet those requirements. It requires insurers to offer a discount premium relating to wind coverage. On to page 59, section 57. This creates the Strengthen Minnesota Homes program in the Department of Commerce. Page 63, section 58, prohibits discrimination against certain breeds or mix of breeds in homeowners' liability insurance. On to page 64. Sections 60 and 62 relate to the prohibition against excessive prescription drug increases. Sorry, that's 60, 61, and 62. On to page 69, section 62 and 63, make conforming changes. On page 71, section 64 requires the Commissioner of Commerce to evaluate existing statutory health benefit mandates. Section 65 requires the Commissioner of Health, in consultation with the Commissioner of Commerce and others, to review the geographic accessibility and network adequacy of HMOs. And then on to page 72, section 66. This relates to changes and repeals for Minnesota rules relating to groups of self-insured motor vehicles. And on page 73, we have the repealer, section 67, and that's all for Article 2. Page 73, Article 3, financial institutions. Sections 1 to 10 regulate payday loans. These are referred to as consumer small and short-term loans. They place limitations on interest. That's all I got. Page 81, sections 11 and 12 require banks and credit unions to submit climate risk disclosure surveys if they have over $1 billion in assets to the Commissioner of Commerce. On to page 82, sections 14 to 60 codify the Model Money Transmission Modernization Act from the Conference of State Bank Supervisors. This was included in the governor's bill. And that takes us from sections 14 to 60. So next reference is on page 129. On page 129, sections 62 to 66 create requirements relating to financial conditions and corporate governance for mortgage services or subservicers that service at least 2,000 residential mortgage loans. And that takes us to page 140. Section 67, the pertinent language is at the top of page 140, and this aligns the limitation for sales and securities under a small corporate offering to align with limits under federal regulations versus state. Section 68 to 72 relate to coerced debt. And that takes us to page 145, section 73 relates on to unaudited financial statements in the Commissioner of Commerce. Section 74 places requirements on the Minnesota Council on Economic Education and what they can do with grants issued to them under this act. And the last page of this is section 146 and a repealer. On to page 147. 147 is Article 4, Commercial Regulation and Consumer Protection. Section 1 relates to the Age Appropriate Design Act. Sections 2, 3 refer to, 2, 3, and 4 relate to Global Positioning System Starter Interrupt Devices and require disclosures by dealers when those are part of a motor vehicle. Section 5 on page 148 relates to warranty repairs paid by a motor vehicle manufacturer to a motor vehicle dealer and outlines what guidelines should be used to set the payment parameters. Section 6 on page 149 repeals the below-cost gasoline requirement. Section 7 and 8, beginning on page 150, relate to deceptive trade practices, and they add the terms unfair and unconscionable acts to the list of prohibited behaviors, also referencing that are sections 14 and 17, which are later in this act. On to section 9 on page 151. This is the Digital Fare Repair Act. And that takes us to page 156, abnormal market disruptions, unconscionably excessive prices. This creates a system by which if there is an abnormal market disruption, sellers of essential consumer goods and services are prohibited from charging unconscionably excessive prices. It also explains what that means. Page 157, sections 11 and 12 require a used motor vehicle that has 75,000 miles or more to have a warranty in effect for 15 days or 500 miles, whichever comes first. This is an addition. Page 160, section 13, this corrects an error. On to page 162, section 16. This creates a private enforcement right for family farmers who have been subject to a violation of the Prevention of Consumer Fraud Act. On page 162, section 17 is the Genetic Information Privacy Act. And this goes through page 167. On page 167, we have section 18, and this relates to credit card charge disclosures and how the disclosure must be offered to purchasers when they're purchasing orally, in person, or online. On to page 168, sections 19 to 23 create the Minnesota Age Appropriate Design Code Act. And that goes all the way to page 176, where we have the repealer and effective dates. And that's it for Article 4. Article 5, page 177, miscellaneous commerce policies. Sections 1 and sections 3 to 10 relate to manufactured home park billing for utilities. Section 2 relates to tribal government's request for telecommunications pricing plans. On to page 181, sections 11 to 14 relate to common interest communities, and they require disclosures relating to foreclosures and liens from fines or assessments placed against a unit. And that takes us to page 194, which has the repealer for this portion of the bill. And that is it for the policy.
Thank you. Next, we'll take public testimony. I'm going to remind people that we have a two-minute limit per testifier. I might give the first testifier a little extra leeway because it is the Commissioner of Commerce, Grace Arnold. Commissioner Arnold, welcome back to the committee. But for everybody else, I'll be pretty strict about the 2 minutes to try and keep this.
All right. Thank you, Chair Stevenson and members. I'll try to do the 2 minutes, even though I might get an extra little bit. So for the record, I'm Grace Arnold, and I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Commerce. And I'm here today to thank Chair Stevenson and members and to express my strong support for House File 2680, the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Omnibus Bill. It includes really important policy and budget items that will benefit every Minnesotan and help the Commerce Department to continue providing services to both consumers and businesses across Minnesota. I'm really pleased to see the governor's budget for commerce has been included in this omnibus bill, and it will provide critical resources to our insurance, enforcement, and external affairs divisions, which will help ensure a strong and competitive marketplace and to better protect Minnesota consumers. I'll do a quick highlight of the provisions that the department that were part of the governor's budget that are in this omnibus. Our fraud bureau will have body worn cameras, which is great for them to maintain transparency in their work. Minnesotans will be able to more easily compare health plans through our standardized plan proposal. Seniors will have additional resources in preventing fraud, both for fraud prevention and investigation. We'll be looking at how we can deliver free primary care to Minnesotans. We'll have investments in our core operations of the insurance division and the rest of our divisions across the board. And we'll be making Minnesota's homes more resilient in the face of extreme weather through our Strengthen Minnesota Homes program. So I want to also express my gratitude and thanks for including the policy proposals in this bill. So the Strengthen Minnesota Homes has a budget and policy component, which are carried in different in the two of our committees. But we also are adding a reference to tribal governments and the telecommunications statute, which will allow them to better negotiate with telecom providers for on behalf of their members. We are also adding state regulatory prudential standards for non-bank mortgage servicers. So if you're getting your mortgage through a non-bank, you can expect them to have the same prudential standards that a bank would have. And then we have a variety of technical and housekeeping bills, including a requirement to have Minnesota health plans cover preventive health services at the level that they currently are. That's codifying parts of the Affordable Care Act, which is really important to making sure that Minnesotans are getting mammograms and colonoscopies and other really really critical preventive services. So these policy proposals will provide the Commerce Department with the necessary tools to continue protecting the public interest through consumer protection, consumer education, assistance to consumers, safety, health, and financial security. And we'll also be working to lower inequities as we continue to serve as a trusted resource for Minnesota consumers and businesses. For these reasons, I urge support of House File 2680, and thank you all for all the work that's gone into this.
Thank you, Commissioner. Before we continue with the list of testimony, there was one housekeeping item that I neglected to mention when we're discussing the markup, and probably would have been instructive as we're talking about the fiscal elements of the bill. We did receive a target of $10 million over base in the biennium, and the second in the tails, it's a more complicated because of the operation of the reinsurance transfer, but it's a $10 million in the tails once you account for the reinsurance transfer. That makes sense. I mentioned that to say that when we get to amendments on Wednesday, in order to be in order, an amendment must keep the bill in balance. The committee will not consider amendments that throw the bill out of balance, taking us above our tails target. Just want to make that clear to the committee members. All right, so now we'll move to public testimony, and I'll give two names so that both people can come up, and then the person who's not testifying can sit in the other chair, and we'll just keep doing that so we move more quickly. So first we have Jason Flakenkuhl from the Attorney General's Office, who will be followed by Robert Hader. So Mr. Hader, if you come up and take the other chair, and then you'll go after Mr. Flakenkuhl. Mr. Flakenkuhl, welcome back.
Good afternoon. My name is Jason Flakenkuhl. I am an Assistant Attorney General and Manager of the Consumer Wage and Antitrust Division of the Office, and I'm here today to testify on behalf of the Office in strong support of House File 2680, which contains numerous important consumer protection provisions that will help Minnesotans afford their lives and live with dignity and respect. Although there's much to praise about the bill, I'd like to primarily focus on five areas that the Attorney General's Office has supported throughout the session. First, Article 2 of the bill contains the prohibition on generic prescription drug price gouging and would make Minnesota the eighth state in the country to create a prescription drug affordability board. These sections embody two of the 14 recommendations made in the final report of Attorney General Ellison's bipartisan drug price task force and would help Minnesotans rein in the high costs its consumers pay for life-saving medications. Second, Article 3 of the bill makes important and consumer-friendly updates to Minnesota's payday lending laws. It does so by prohibiting excessive finance charges and replacing them with a clear 36% annual interest rate cap. Just as importantly, the bill contains anti-evasion provisions that will make it far harder for payday lenders to try to extract usurious interest rates from Minnesota consumers by disguising the true nature of those transactions. The AG's office has brought numerous enforcement actions against payday lenders and disguised payday loans and strongly supports these measures to better protect Minnesota borrowers. Third, Article 4 of the bill contains the Digital Fair Repair Act, which will increase consumer choice and competition when equipment that contains embedded software or electronics breaks down and needs repair. This portion of the bill is pro-consumer because it allows consumers to repair rather than replace their consumer electronics. It's pro-small business because it would allow Minnesota small businesses providing repair services to compete against large equipment manufacturers. And it's also pro-farmer because it would allow farmers to more quickly repair equipment they rely on and at a more reasonable price. The AG's office can bring enforcement actions against violators of the act and strongly supports its passage. Fourth, Article 4 of the bill also contains the Minnesota Age Appropriate Design Code, which will enhance online privacy and safety protections for Minnesota's youth and children who are increasingly navigating a digital world. These provisions closely align with the work the AG's office is currently doing by participating in a bipartisan coalition of attorneys generals from across the nation investigating the practices of both Facebook and TikTok. These investigations are focused, among other things, on the design features and techniques that these companies have used to boost engagement by young users and the resulting harm that's resulted. Finally, Article 4 also makes long overdue updates to Minnesota's core consumer protection statutes by prohibiting unfair acts or practices. 44 states and the District of Columbia, ranging in political makeup from California to West Virginia, all protect their consumers from unfair or unconscionable acts or practices, but presently Minnesota law doesn't. This bill would fix that and bring Minnesota's consumer protection laws into conformity with the vast majority of other states. It would allow the Attorney General's office to better protect consumers, especially when they're victims of conduct that's unfair but not necessarily deceptive. Thank you for including these and many other important consumer protection initiatives within House File 2680. Attorney General Ellison welcomes the enforcement role he will play with respect to these protections and strongly urges the committee to support their enactment. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Robert Hayter, who will be followed by Michelle Mack.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Robert Hayter, and I am the legislative director at Take Action Minnesota. We are a statewide multiracial peoples organization with 15 years of experience working on state health care policy, ranging from Medicaid expansion to prescription drug costs. I'm here today to support the Prescription Drug Affordability Board provisions within House File 2680 and to share context why this bill is so critical. First, federal action on prescription drugs are few and far between. Medicare Part D was established 20 years ago, and drug cost provisions in the recently passed Inflation Reduction Act will only lower the cost for some medicines for some Medicare patients at some point in the next 5 years. When it comes to key health care policy, states have always done the heavy lifting on the policy development that makes federal action feasible. We have all paid the price for decades of inaction on drug costs, which is why these provisions are so important. A PDAV will lower prescription drug costs for patients, payers, and providers. Minnesota is well positioned to establish an effective PDAV and learn from states that are currently implementing boards despite industry efforts to stall. Lastly, we support a PDAV because our government has a responsibility to address the out of control costs of taxpayer funded drugs. Nearly every medicine on the market today comes from decades of publicly funded research. Our tax dollars fund everything from the research and development of treatment for rare diseases to COVID-19 vaccines, which received over $18 billion in publicly funded R&D and manufacturing. Even with the degree to which we, the taxpayers, support R&D, we're still forced to pay high prices for prescription drugs in our public health care programs and at the pharmacy. At the same time, CEOs are legally permitted to price gouge life-saving medications while spending tens of millions of dollars on lobbying, advertising, and stock buybacks. Minnesotans deserve a better deal. Prescription drugs do not work if people cannot afford them. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Michelle Mack, who will be followed by Sarah Pacek.
Good afternoon, Chair Stevenson and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Mack, and I'm a senior director at the Pharmaceutical Care Management Association, otherwise known as PCMA. PCMA represents America's Pharmacy Benefit Managers, or PBMs. PCMA appreciates the opportunity to testify in House Bill 2680 as it relates to Article 2, Section 55, relative to clinician-administered drugs, also referred to as white bagging. PCMA and its members are very appreciative of Chair Stevenson and all of his time and work in this matter, along with the sponsor, Representative Freiberg. We believe the current language in the DE1 of the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Omnibus Bill strikes the right balance on this issue because it does not force providers to accept white bagging if they do not want to do so. It still allows affordable access, while at the same time addresses cost concerns and cost containment. However, the current language is not clear that it does not impact employer-sponsored plans. As this moves along through the process, we look forward to discussing and working on this further. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Next, we have Sarah Pasick, who will be followed by Tony Quillis. Ms. Pasick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Pasick, and I'm here on behalf of CTIA, the Trade Association for Wireless Communications Industry. I'm speaking in opposition to the digital fare repair provisions included in the bill. The marketplace already provides a wide range of consumer choice for electronic product repair without the mandates imposed by this legislation. For example, manufacturers have relationships with authorized repair providers, and these providers, which include local small businesses, have received the appropriate training from manufacturers to help ensure that repairs are done properly and safely. Manufacturers may also offer walk-in repair options at retail as well as many mail-in services. Insurance providers offer repair options for consumers, including authorized third-party remote technicians that will travel to the consumer to perform repairs. And manufacturers have expanded repair options from growing the number of authorized repair providers to increasing access to tools, parts, and manuals directly to consumers. To further address the repair marketplace, CTIA launched two programs, one for repair technicians and one for retailers. These programs educate and test wireless repair technicians on industry-recognized standards. We are concerned that this bill would have the unintended consequence of eliminating the need for repairers to demonstrate to consumers that they have the technical competence to perform safe, secure, and reliable repairs. CTIA is also concerned that the legislation has the potential to weaken the privacy and security features of electronic products. The security of user information is of the utmost importance to consumers, and with broad and unchecked access to technical information, security protections could be easily circumvented. In an era of sophisticated cyber attacks, we should not make it easier to hack devices and networks. Consumers expect and rely on the safety and security of their electronic products. So for these reasons, CTIA opposes the legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Tony Quillis, who will be followed by Bentley Graves. Mr. Quillis.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Tony Quillis, and I'm representing the Consumer Technology Association. They're a trade association with just under 1,400 members representing manufacturers and retailers in the technology industry. Mr. Chairman, in specific to House File 2680, it's Article 4, Section 9 that Ms. Pasick just referenced, the digital fare repair language. Preferred approach for the Consumer Technology Association would be a national law, or a national memorandum of understanding. But short of that goal, we'd like to prevent a patchwork of rules and regulations that could be confusing to all stakeholders. Only one other state has passed a law along these regulating this, and that has been the state of New York. There have been some constructive conversations among stakeholders to attempt to provide some clarity and consistency with the elements of the New York law, as well as with the proposed Minnesota law, to prevent the patchwork that I had just previously mentioned. Unfortunately, we have to oppose the language that's in the bill because we've not reached a mutual agreement yet. There's still some outstanding issues, like Ms. Pasick had mentioned, but also along definitions, electronic security locks, and some of the implementation issues. But conversations are ongoing, Mr. Chairman and members, and we look forward to continued participation with the advocates as well as other stakeholders as this bill moves through the process.
Thank you, Mr. Quillis. Next is Bentley Graves, who will be followed by Buck Humphrey. Mr. Graves.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Bentley Graves with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I want to start by thanking the chair of this committee for the work that's been done thus far on the white bagging issue. You heard some summary of it before. I think we'll hear more conversation about it going forward. But when the bill was heard in this committee, there's a commitment made to try and find a way forward on that bill and find peace in the valley. And while I suspect there's much feedback yet to be offered on the language in the bill, we want to appreciate the work the chair has done and the committee has done and Representative Freiberg has done so far to find consensus. We appreciate that the amount of work that's been done on this bill so far. We also support the changes to the mandate review process that are made in the bill to make it make that process better and more accessible and improve it. And we appreciate the steps that the bill takes to take that process a little bit further and start using it as a means to get a sense of the cost benefit of the many health insurance requirements that we already have in statute, so that both policymakers and stakeholders collectively can start to get a sense of what is in statute, the impact it's had on coverage thus far, the impact it's had on cost, and the impact it's had on public health. We do still have some concerns about the bill. When it comes to mandates, we would note that there are some additional mandates being proposed in this bill, and we note that that's done at a time when our friends at CHADEC at the University of Minnesota tell us that Minnesotans currently pay more for their all-in health coverage costs than almost anybody in any other state. So we would always urge caution when looking to add to what is already a very long list in the state of Minnesota. And part of that too, we would continue to urge caution about the reinsurance program. The bill as it sits today would largely end that program in 2025 at a time when additional federal subsidies may be going away for the individual market and a time when the state may be moving on to a public option of some kind. Our view is that has been a very effective and helpful stability mechanism that can continue to serve the state well, and we hope will do so in the future. And then finally, we do continue to have concerns about the approach of a prescription drug affordability board. I'm sure you'll hear many industry-specific thoughts about that again today. But by and large, our concerns are about the precedent that this sets for the state setting prices in a competitive market for privately produced products. Appreciate the opportunity to offer this testimony today, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Next, we have Buck Humphrey, who will be followed by Andrew O'Connor. Mr. Humphrey.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Buck Humphrey, and I represent the Minnesota Pharmacy Alliance, which is made up of both retail and health system pharmacists, as well as the college at the U. I'm here testifying today in conjunction with the White Bagging Choice Coalition, which is made up of doctors, pharmacists, infusion centers, and patients who utilize critical infusion health services throughout Minnesota. I draw your attention to the White Bagging Choice issue brief in your packets and posted for further information about the practice of white bagging. Happy to talk to you after about exactly what white bagging is if you couldn't figure it out from our testimony earlier, and appreciate working here on behalf of members. I want to thank Chair Stevenson and our author, Representative Freiberg, and the many members of this committee who have come to understand the real impact to patient care caused by insurer payer mandates, and specifically the mandate of white bagging in the area of clinician-administered infusion medications. White bagging in Minnesota, which I note is predominantly a payer policy that only benefits large PBMs located outside of Minnesota, some of the self-funded, or almost all of the white bagging is done by the self-funded MCO-managed insurance plans outside of Minnesota, but affects millions of Minnesotans in Minnesota who have those health insurance plans providing that coverage for them. White bagging has delayed the administration of medications, sometimes for months, in oncology, critical eye disease, and other complex clinical injection care for patients. White bagging has wasted expensive medications, endangered the pedigree of the drugs being white bagged, and in general has had an acute and gross impact to patient care and the ability of our providers to deliver timely, specialized patient care. The language included in Article 2, Section 55 of the bill, which is the amendment language heard before this committee on an informational basis, does not prohibit the mandate of insurer PBM white bagging. for patients' critically administered injectable medications. It has been turned into a cost containment provision from the coalition's perspective and does not resolve the issue of payer-mandated white bagging. For these reasons, we oppose the language included here today. However, the coalition appreciates good faith efforts and the work from insurers and their PBMs. To date, both the White Bagging Coalition as well as payer PBM insurer stakeholders have been meeting in earnest, including over the weekend. We really appreciate their good faith efforts to come to some type of consensus. We hope to have that even within this week potentially, but there is still much work to be done. We thank the chair and Representative Freiberg and the committee for looking at this important issue and resolving it for those patients who desperately need this issue resolved. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Humphrey. And since we've heard now from both sides of the white bagging issue, I also thank both sides for their continued work to try and reach an amicable solution. I appreciate your hard work over the weekend and otherwise.
Thank you for noting, Chair.
Next, we have Andrew O'Connor, who will be followed by Beth Cadoon. Mr. O'Connor.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andrew O'Connor. I'm from the Entertainment Software Association. We are a trade association representing video game console makers and game publishers. I'm here today to respectfully oppose House File 2680, specifically provisions contained in Article 4 regarding the Digital Fair Repair Act and the Age-Appropriate Design Code. We've submitted written testimony which outlines our concerns on those provisions in more details. For the sake of testimony, I'll just focus on a few key things. First, for right to repair, I want to echo the concerns that have been raised by folks that have testified before me and also reiterate that we have been having some very productive conversations with the proponents of this legislation, sponsors both in the House and in the Senate. We're getting closer and closer to what I think would be a good kind of peace in the valley for all sides. So I appreciate all of your time and patience as we work through those last few issues. Specifically for us, and I've testified before this committee on this issue before, we have concerns with the lack of copyright protections outlined in this bill for an industry that relies on protecting its copyright from piracy and other sophisticated attacks. These are crucial for our industry to survive and to continue to flourish and provide entertainment for folks of all ages. Moving to the AADC, while we appreciate the intent of the bill and acknowledge that keeping children safe online is a priority, this bill is not the proper vehicle to do that. The video game industry has long supported efforts to keep children safe and has been a leader in this space for decades. For nearly 30 years, the Entertainment Software Ratings Bureau, or Board, has independently assigned age ratings for video games and mobile apps, educated parents about age ratings, parental controls, and privacy-related topics, enforced industry-adopted ad guidelines, and worked with major retailers to help children access appropriate content. Portions of this bill set forth unclear, unworkable legal standards and will make compliance difficult for companies. Differences in the California law will create a challenge for Minnesota. Also, the bill is based off of a guidance from the United Kingdom, which will be difficult to import into our existing legal framework due to the First Amendment, COPPA, and other existing privacy frameworks. Finally, key components of this legislation that have passed in California are currently being litigated. We ask that Minnesota not pass this until those constitutional arguments are resolved. That's all for my testimony. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next, we have Beth Cadoon, who will be followed by Mary Jo George. Ms. Cadoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Beth Cadoon. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm also here representing the Minnesota's for Lawsuit Reform Coalition. I'll be testifying on the provisions in Article 4, Section 7, 14, and 15. It is our understanding there will be an amendment on Wednesday to address some of the concern we'd raised last week, and we would urge you to support that language and thank Chair Stevenson for working with us to address those concerns we had on litigation risks and some of the uncertain terms in that language. This provision modifies the Uniform Deceptive Trade Practices Act and the Consumer Fraud Statutes. We certainly want to make sure consumers are protected from bad actors. However, we also want to make sure that lawful businesses have clarity around the law and do not have unnecessary lawsuit risk and exposure due to undefined terms and lack of clarity. The bill, as originally written, was broader than just consumers, as it also would have given business competitors substantial power to sue over nearly all business activity that they individually consider as harmful. The amendment will address this concern by removing the language that would allow businesses to sue for harm to competition based on harm to their business rather than under the well-established standard for antitrust injury looking at the pro-consumer benefits. The amendment will also address some vague terms. So we urge your adoption of the amendment, and we'd also like to continue the conversation on this bill to see if there's additional clarity as this moves through the process. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is Mary Jo George, who will be followed by J.R. Burke. Ms. George.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Mary Jo George, and I'm the Advocacy Director for AARP Minnesota. On behalf of our members, AARP strongly supports the provisions in House File 2680 that establish a state drug affordability review board and prohibits price gouging by generic manufacturers. Lowering the cost of prescription drugs is a high priority for AARP, especially as we continue to see prescription drugs prices skyrocket. Every day we hear stories from members facing serious health and financial consequences due to the high cost of prescription drugs. And the reality is that we're often talking about costs that patients will face every year for the rest of their lives. Take, for example, Jessica, who many of you have heard from. Her medication for her arthritis costs over $4,000 a month, and that is a discounted price. It's normally over $6,000 a month. This is more than double her mortgage, but she needs it, but it's causing major financial strain. Or take Kate, who has to make an impossible choice that no mother ever should in deciding which of her children with life-threatening allergies will use the $1,500 EpiPen. So it's stories like these that keep bringing us back and urging lawmakers to rein in the high cost of drugs. And then finally, I just want to say we know that high-cost drugs hurt everyone, not only those who struggle daily to afford needed life-saving medications, but all of us who are paying higher premiums and out-of-pocket costs, as well as taxpayers who are helping to fund public programs. And so that's why we think the Affordability Board and price gouging provisions working together can help lower drug prices and save tens of millions of dollars for patients, taxpayers, and our healthcare system. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, we have J.R. Burke, who will be followed by Joe Selwood. Mr. Burke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is J.R. Burke. For the record, I'm with Polaris. I want to thank you again for taking some testimony from Polaris. I spoke to this committee a few weeks back. I wanted to draw your attention specifically to our comments on digital repair in Article 4, Section 9, more specifically line 159.13. The Senate file has made some important updates that we would encourage this committee to also consider. They're also consistent with the law that was referenced earlier in New York, specifically with respect to non-road equipment. Mr. Chair and members, when you think about non-road equipment, think about the types of products that are operated in our forests. They operate over our public waterways, our lakes, our rivers, and they produce our food. And so Polaris is very concerned with, obviously, consumer safety, but also environmental protections that come with this exclusion that the Senate has already adopted. But there's still a little bit of work to be done, though, as well, in both the Senate bill and in this House file. More specifically, on line 153.29, the motor vehicle definition has the effect of excluding motor vehicles, but then there's an exclusion of motorcycles from the motor vehicle definition, therefore including it. Some of the advocate groups who provided some model legislation on what a motor vehicle is under their definition do not make a similar distinction. In fact, Minnesota law today considers motorcycles a type of motor vehicle, as does the federal government under the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards, as well as the EPA under the Clean Air Act. So we think that's contrary to state law, federal law, and certainly some of the advocates. The fix is simple. It's really striking the term a motorcycle under the definition of motor vehicle. And interestingly enough, as I mentioned, the New York law, I'm very familiar with that law. I worked on that law. Governor Hochul actually made it conditional through a chapter amendment that the term motorcycle be stricken, as would be proposed here, in order to ultimately make that law effective. So in the only law in the country where digital repair is effective today, motorcycles are not treated similarly as to what is proposed here under this bill. So I would certainly encourage Mr. Chair, you and your colleagues' consideration of our comments, and certainly happy to answer any questions you may have as we go along with this process. So thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Joe Selwood, who will be followed by Gary Wordish. Mr. Selwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Joe Selwood, and I'm testifying on behalf of the Association for Accessible Medicines, the Trade Association for Generic and Biosimilar Manufacturers. AAM is opposed to the language in Article 2, Sections 23 to 39, specifically the provisions allowing the Attorney General and private individuals to sue generic manufacturers, prohibiting generic manufacturers from discontinuing drugs in Minnesota, requiring reporting when production is paused or discontinued, and including significant financial penalties. The language targets only generic drug manufacturers and does not apply to the many examples of high-cost brand drugs cited as evidence for the necessity of the proposal. Last week, the U.S. Senate Committee on Homeland Security released a report on the health and national security risks of our current historic drug shortages. Citing the lack of incentives as a significant driver, it states, with few incentives to enter the market or remain in the market for a narrow but critical set of generic drugs, manufacturers of these products often decide to leave the market, and few, if any, others decide to enter. Why would you impose more hurdles for a critical market that is already lacking incentives? The report concludes that these shortage risks carry devastating yet avoidable consequences for all Americans, including our military. This proposal has significant legal concerns, which are not theoretical. In 2018, a federal court ruled that a similar law in Maryland was unconstitutional. In December, New York's governor, a Democrat, vetoed the bill, stating it could exacerbate already existing drug shortages. In 2021, Maine's governor, a Democrat, wisely stated in her veto letter, whether as district attorney, attorney general, or as governor, I have never shied away from a legal battle that I knew was right and that would benefit the people of Maine. This is not such an occasion. Please support low-cost generic drugs and oppose the language in Article 2, Sections 23 to 39. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thanks.
Next is Gary Wordish, who will be followed by Judy Cook. Mr. Wordish.
Good afternoon, Chair Stevenson and committee members. My name is Gary Wordish, and I'm president of the Minnesota Farmers Union, which is a grassroots organization that has represented family farmers, ranchers, excuse me, and rural communities since 1918. I am here today to voice our support for several provisions in House File 2680. This includes provisions that will help curb the skyrocketing costs of prescription drugs and provisions that will create fair and competitive markets for the repair of agricultural equipment. Healthcare affordability is a top concern of our members, and rising prescription drug costs are a key financial pressure. MFU is very happy to see a language creating a prescription drug affordability board and new prohibition on price gouging of medicine are included in this legislation. These measures will create new tools to rein in healthcare costs in Minnesota. MFU is also excited that this legislation includes digital fair repair provisions that cover agricultural equipment. MFU strongly supports broad right to repair legislation that holds all manufacturers accountable for using digital technology to lock owners out of the things they own. Right to repair is critical to generally competitive market for repair services. With just three companies manufacturing 95% of the large tractors, the effective monopoly on repair increased costs and wait time for repairs. It is our belief that this legislation will create a fair and open market for repairs that can support a healthy network of dealerships and repair shops. Right now, we don't have that, as farmers are held captive to the large original equipment manufacturers. Many of our members receive excellent service from their local dealership and believe there is room for more independent technicians and independent farmers to engage in repair. That is why MFU worked hard to develop the language in sub 2 of the fair repair language in section 9, which we believe gives dealerships the right to earn a fair margin on parts. Finally, I want to address recent memorandums of understanding on this issue that have been signed by major equipment manufacturers. While we appreciate the work that went into these MOUs, they are not a substitute for legal protections. Giving farmers a legal right to repair will create mechanisms for enforcement and ensure that all farmers can fix the equipment that is essential to their business. MOUs on right to repair have been signed in the past with promises and nothing changed. Currently, small and mid-sized farmers are at a disadvantage, as there is a financial incentive for dealers to take care of their large farmers' customers first. Thank you again, Mr. Chair, for inclusion of these provisions in your ominous bill. We hope the committee will support this language and make it law in Minnesota.
Thank you. Next is Judy Cook, who will be followed by Bill Straczynski. Ms. Cook.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Judy Cook, and I am here today representing TechNet. It is a TechNet is a technology trade association representing over 100 innovative companies. TechNet remains opposed to two provisions that are contained in this bill. The first is the digital repair provisions, and the other is the Minnesota age-appropriate design code. We've been before the committee before stating our opposition, and others have testified, so I will keep my testimony brief. First, on the digital repair language, while TechNet remains in opposition to the repair provisions as contained in this bill, we remain committed to continuing our work with the proponents and authors of the bill to get to a final product that works for all stakeholders. Over the past several weeks, TechNet has been in communication with the proponents of the language and have identified areas we agree on, areas that need more discussion, and areas that may be sticking point. However, I believe that those issues can be overcome in any final product. I want to assure you that we are working with the advocates in good faith to find language that works for everyone, language that protects the integrity of the devices sold in the state, protects the privacy of your constituents, all while giving advocates what they sought to achieve. We are asking you to encourage all parties to continue to work together and include any agreement we reach in the final bill. The second area of the bill that is concern is the new internet regulations that the age-appropriate design code would put on all businesses in the state, not just tech companies. It would mandate the collection of more data of Minnesota residents at a time when we are being asked to collect less information. If enacted, it would undoubtedly be challenged with the ongoing pending lawsuit in the District Court of California, which is a law that this bill is modeled after. The bill has vague terms that will make compliance challenging, among many, many other concerns that I won't highlight today, others have mentioned. We encourage you not to include AADC in this bill to allow ample time for review and discussion of this important issue of protecting the privacy of children. Thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Straczynski, you can introduce yourself for the record, and up next is Shep Harris.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill Straczynski, and I'm with the Libby Law Firm, and I'm here today representing the interests of the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association. Our association represents the petroleum marketers and licensed distributors who own and operate a majority of the 2,500 convenience stores, truck stops, and refueling sites found throughout Minnesota. You know your neighborhood gas station, basically. I'm here today to voice MPMA's strong opposition to Section 6, which is on page 149 of the Delete Amendment, which repeals the decades-old statute that addresses unlawful gasoline sales. The supporters of this proposed language have stated two reasons for the repeal. One, they believe it will lower the price of gasoline. And two, they believe that it would provide for free and open trade. According to a study, and I have the study here actually, which was published in the Journal of Urban Economics, in those states that have a law like ours, and I think there's 13 of them, gasoline was actually 1 cent a gallon cheaper than in those states that don't have such a law. The realistic conclusion is that repealing the current law will not impact fuel prices. Stated another way, there is no connection between this law, which is used to identify predatory pricing, and the price the consumer pays at the pump. Only healthy, vibrant competition guaranteed by protecting small retailers from below-cost pricing ensures the lowest price for the consumers. Now, regarding the necessity of free and open trade argument, I urge you to consider the following. This law came into being 20 years ago because of the predatory practices that were being conducted by some of the big box stores when they entered the marketplace in Minnesota and used gasoline as a loss leader in order to attract customers to their operations. Several small retailers were then forced out of business, particularly in the smaller communities throughout the state of Minnesota. They just simply couldn't compete. I was involved then in a discussion with the Attorney General, Mike Hatch, who was asked how the state can stop this practice. We asked him that. He informed us that the trade protections afforded under the law at the time was insufficient and very difficult to enforce. And if you repeal this law today, it goes back to that underlying statute.
Thank you, Mr. Straczynski. I'll ask you to wrap up quickly, please.
Okay. Well, so the Attorney General helped craft the new law, which is currently on the books before us. In conclusion, should you repeal this law, you will find unfair and predatory pricing starting to occur just like it did before the law was enacted. And you'll have fewer competitors, and that just seems wrong. Keeping healthy and vibrant competition is the key to providing consumer with choices. Ask yourself, who supports this law and who benefits this law? Cui bono, who benefits? It's not the consumers. They didn't ask you for this law change. It's not the small marketers. It's the big box out-of-state retailers. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, we urge you on Wednesday that hopefully there'll be an amendment to take this section out of the bill that you will consider supporting that language.
Thank you for
It's all about your local marketer. Thank you.
Mr. Harris, you can introduce yourself for the record and proceed. And next up is Caitlin Bemis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, my name is Shep Harris. I'm with Fredrickson and Byron. I'm here on behalf of the Fair Repair Coalition in support of including in the DE amendment to House File 2680, the Fair Repair Act. First of all, just thank you to Chair Stevenson and to many members of this committee who are also co-authors on this bill for including it in the DE amendment. Just as a refresher, you've heard this from a couple of other testifiers already. This is designed to offer parts, tools, and instructions from original equipment manufacturers at a fair and reasonable cost to multiple industries. There are two exclusions in the language, as you'll see, for medical devices and for motor vehicles. But members, this is very important. This language is very important to a variety of sectors here in Minnesota. You've already heard several weeks ago from a number of them, including consumers, businesses such as large and small IT refurbishing companies, environmental businesses, environmental advocacy groups, local governments, and as you just heard, farmers as well. And as you've also heard from some of the opponents or members that organizations that have expressed concern, we are working with those groups to try to find some clarifying language so that there is no misunderstanding. And we appreciate this inclusion of the language as it moves forward. As we get that clarifying language, we'll bring it forward. So we look forward to that and appreciate your patience and flexibility. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Bemis, you can introduce yourself and proceed. And next we'll have Sue Abderholden.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Caitlin Bemis, and I'm the Public Policy Specialist at Minnesota Farm Bureau, where I have the privilege of representing nearly 30,000 farm and ranch families from across the state of Minnesota. Thank you for all the work you have done throughout this legislative session and for allowing me to testify today. I would like to share Farm Bureau's concerns around the Digital Fair Repair Act legislation. Earlier this year, the American Farm Bureau Federation signed a memorandum of understanding with John Deere, in which John Deere has committed to give their customers access to tools, manuals, and software. This MOU stems from 2 years of negotiations between the two organizations and so far has been very successful. Due to this private solution, we believe this memorandum of understanding deserves the opportunity to show it can be successful. In addition, MFBF advocates that if legislation is necessary to resolve the right to repair issues in agriculture, that the solution should be produced at the federal level, and should John Deere not fulfill their end of the bargain, my federal counterparts are ready to push for federal legislation. Creating state-level legislation for a federal issue will only stand to place Minnesota farmers on a regulatory island amongst our peers. Some testifiers have mentioned the New York exemption, and I would like to echo support for the agriculture and off-road exemption. Following the success of the John Deere MOU, AFBF has signed yet another MOU with Case New Holland, and will continue to work with other manufacturers to ensure that farmers get the access to tools they need to repair their equipment. Thank you.
Thank you for your time. Ms. Abderholden, you can introduce yourself and proceed. Next, we have Dan Andreessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, and we appreciate the time and attention in this bill to ensuring access to mental health treatment and services. In particular, we want to express our support for the following provisions. One is creating and funding the Mental Health Parity and Substance Abuse Accountability Office. We think that's an important part of enforcing that law. Also, mandating coverage of our psychiatric residential treatment facilities, which are clearly needed to meet the extraordinary complex mental health needs of our children and youth. And if you read Sunday Star Tribune article by Chris Novak, you'll really understand that need. Also changing the exclusion timeline related to suicide for life insurance policies or certificates from 2 years to 1 year, and updating some of the language related to suicide. Adopting broader network adequacy standards than 30 miles, 30 minutes for mental health services. There are better standards such as provider covered person ratios, waiting times, ability to meet diverse communities, and other measures. The study should also help guide this work. Allowing any willing mental health provider for the next 2 years to address the mental health crisis of Minnesotans. Creating a floor for timely filings under Medicaid managed care to ensure that providers receive payments and that we extend that timeline when there are problems resolving a bill. Defining and requiring free preventive services, which includes screenings for depression, suicide, alcohol and drug use, and autism. And lastly, providing coverage for the psychiatric collaborative care model. Again, thank you for including these important provisions.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Mr. Andreessen, you can introduce yourself and proceed, and then following we will have Joel Carlson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. First of all, I just want to thank you for inclusion of language on changes to the benefit mandate review process, as well as doing a review of existing mandates currently in statute. All existing mandates predate the mandate review process that's currently that we currently use. So we think it makes sense to go back to look at previous mandates to see what the financial impacts have been, what were the health outcomes, but also determining whether these mandates are still supported by medical standards. We also thank you for the inclusion of the Prescription Drug Affordability Board, as we think that's a good step forward to address high drug prices, as well as the DE language on the white bagging that's been previously mentioned. We do think this is a compromise that gives both sides what they want. It does prohibit health plan and PBM from mandating white bagging, but also provides patients protection from financial markups of the drug. But as Mr. Humphrey mentioned, we are still working and talking through this language and happy to keep those conversations going. We do have three items that we do request changed in the bill. One is to apply all benefit mandates equally. We have a longstanding position that any mandates be applied to all state regulated markets, so that includes the commercial fully insured market, state public programs, and the CGIP program. Right now, there's language in there that exempts the PRTF and collaborative care model from being covered under CGIP. Those are in Article 2, Section 1, and Section 46. We'd also ask that the effective dates be changed for the benefit mandates in the bill. Right now, they're set to go in effect for plan year 2024. Right now, all plans are finalizing their 2024 plans to be submitted to Commerce, which the department then looks at them over the summer to evaluate those. We would ask that those be changed to the 2025 plan year. We're also asking for some accommodations for the standardized plans and the guaranteed durability law that's currently on the books right now. Health carriers have to continue to offer a plan on the individual market, even if only one person signs up for it. So we don't know if consumers will buy this product. So we just want to have some flexibility, especially if these plans are going to be changing from year to year, and we don't want an outdated product sitting out on the market. And then lastly, I do want to express our concern about the reinsurance transfer to end that program from the premium security account. This has been a successful program in stabilizing the market and bringing down premiums for the 130,000 Minnesotans in that program. I know there is interest in moving a Minnesota Care buy-in. Even if that is enacted, we would still need reinsurance because there's still going to be people in the individual market, and we need to be able to protect them financially and their premiums. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Joel Carlson, who will be followed by Therese Kuvas. Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Joel Carlson here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice. Briefly, I want to thank the committee and you, Chair, for including in Article 2, Section 2, and Section 59. That is Representative Freiberg's bill on the clarifying statute of limitations and the Chair's bill about protecting families from family exclusions. And I only want to say one thing on that point, Mr. Chair and members. We had discussion on criminal exclusions when the bill was heard in committee. And I just want the committee to know that the language in front of you now puts the criminal conduct back in the bill. We've done a lot of research on that issue, and they are authorized under Minnesota law. We thought they were permitted, but I just wanted you to know that that language is back in the bill. With that, Mr. Chairman, the only other comment is that on line 9.22, you mentioned during your comments that you might consider changing the effective date, and we support that change to move that effective date to January 1 of 2024. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. That change will be in the author's amendment that we consider on Wednesday. Ms. Kuvas, followed by Ann Leland Clark. Ms. Kuvas.
Good afternoon. My name is Teresa Kuvas. I represent the Minnesota Bankers Association. We represent 95% of the banks in Minnesota, from the very largest to the very smallest. I'd like to thank you for the inclusion of the part-time branches and the repeal of the director's audit that's in the language and the delete everything, which was part of Representative Cha's legislation. I do want to express some concerns for the climate risk disclosure survey language that's included in the bill. We still believe it's extremely broad. The language states that we need to send a survey into the Department of Commerce, but there's no clarifying language into what a bank needs to send in that regards, and banks like clarity, and so we would like to continue working with the author. We've appreciated meeting with him on that as well. We're also not quite sure what will be done with that language. We know that the bill has been moved from $500 million to $1 billion, and we appreciate the change, but it's still only a handful of state charter community banks that will be impacted by this. When you look at the nationally chartered banks that do climate risk disclosures, they're $100 billion in assets, so it's significantly different. So, again, we continue to have some concerns. We're dedicated to continuing to work, whether it's this session or over the interim, but thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Ann Leland Clark, who will be followed by Cal Makarios. Ms. Leland Clark.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm testifying today in place of my colleague, Ann Leland Clark. My name is Megan Olson-Biebighauser, and I serve as the organizing director at Exodus Lending, a nonprofit that works directly with Minnesotans experiencing the debt trap caused by predatory payday lending. Exodus Lending also convenes the Minnesotans for Fair Lending Coalition, a network of organizations that have worked for over a decade to reform lending practices that trap Minnesotans in cycles of debt and triple-digit interest rates. I'm here today to thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Katiza Watoon, Representative Cagle, for including both the rate cap measure and the loan program funding in this omnibus bill. We're excited that through your leadership, Minnesota will expand the rate cap protections afforded in the Military Lending Act to include veterans and all Minnesotans, and bring Minnesota into alignment with the 18 states and District of Columbia who have capped interest rates before us. To complement these protections, the funding measure included today will help organizations already embedded in vulnerable communities build a more inclusive economy by offering options for financial inclusion that avoid taking on onerous debt. Thanks again for your leadership and for casting a vision that includes increased stability for Minnesota's families. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Kyle Makarios, who will be followed by Mark Hughes. Mr. Makarios.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Kyle Makarios. I'm here today representing the Teamsters Joint Council 32. The Teamsters, along with the Machinist Union, represent a couple thousand automotive technicians who work at the local auto dealers in many of your districts. As this committee heard during testimony on Representative Tabke's bill, House File 797, when those technicians are performing warranty repairs, they're not being fairly compensated because the auto manufacturers determine their own labor time guides that they use to reimburse local auto dealers. As you heard in testimony, those time guides are often dramatically short of the actual time it takes to complete a repair, squeezing both our local auto dealers and the technicians that work for them. The provisions of Representative Tabke's bill included in this delete all amendment in Article 4, Section 5 will fix that, ensuring that members of the Teamsters and machinists and many others that perform this work are compensated fairly. We appreciate its inclusion in this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Makarios. And our final testifier is Mark Hughes. Mr. Hughes.
Hi there. Thanks for the time today. My name is Mark Hughes, and I've been a pace around these parts for a while. And matter of fact, I have worked since about 1976. So now you know how old I am. I'm here today because we talked about drugs and insurance and so on and so forth. I want to tell my story quick. I am not going to feel sorry for myself. I'm going to continue to work. But I'm terminally ill. And I have cancer, and I have a 360 ablation that I take over at Minji. And the reason I bring this up is we got the treatment number 15, and I'm on about 30 now. We're only supposed to have one or two. But then all of a sudden I had to change my internist because my insurance wouldn't pay for U of M Fairview anymore. And so I'm going down to Fairview Clinics. They're doing okay. But my point is, when I'm in the middle of treatment, I would have rather stayed with my general internist that I had. Also, an interesting fact is, when we got to the double numbers, I asked to talk to the surgeon I went to prior to this one. So I did. I went over for an afternoon and a consultation. And I said, if I wouldn't have had to take generic drugs because of my insurance for payment and could have taken the regular drugs, would I have had this many treatments? She said we could probably cut it in half. Now, my point is this. You talk about consumer choice. I didn't have a choice. I had to give up my internist that I liked, a few of them. I'm alone. Second of all, I could have taken a regular prescribed drug for my body instead of a generic and cut these treatments in half. Now, let me be fair. I'm glad they're not telling me to plan my funeral. It's all over. There's nothing we can do. We're still trying, and we're down to about 2%, I'm glad to say. But if the choice would have been given, I would have done a couple things different. And I think if I'm paying for the policy, that I should have a choice. This system is broken. I got to get, if there's somebody in this room who is a CEO of an insurance company, I want to talk to them because I believe it can be fixed. It should be fixed. Not for me, but for all Minnesotans and all Americans. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony today. All right. We've concluded public testimony. We have 6 minutes left in our committee time, so I think if members have any questions about the process going forward or brief clarification questions, not getting into a debate, I'd be happy to entertain those for the next 6 minutes. Otherwise, we can adjourn. Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, Mr. Chair, clarifying, what's the plan for the rest of the week here? We've got committee today that we're finishing up. Wednesday we're going to do the bill. Do you see anything else on the horizon between now and the scheduled break of next week that the committee will be needing to undertake in the way of business?
I have no plans to call any additional hearings between now and the break, but I am also not entirely ruling it out. But I have, as I sit here today, zero plans to do anything other than mark up and vote out the bill on Wednesday.
Mr. Chair. One other question that I have, and maybe we can get some additional information between now and Wednesday. I noticed that in the budget we're talking about taking money out of the security premium account, which is where reinsurance is funded, the very, very successful program that's been offered here in the state of Minnesota and being replicated across the nation. I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about the solvency of where that plan is going to be after we take money out of that account to pay for other priorities. Don't have to have an answer today, but I'm just wondering if we can get some information for the committee on Wednesday on that topic.
Well, I can tell you from, and I'm happy to ask the for other people to be available to make sure we have ability to answer that question. Here's what I understand the state of play to be on the reinsurance question. In the last legislative session, we passed a bill to reauthorize the reinsurance program for an additional 5 years, to have the authority to operate for 5 years, but we only authorized enough money to operate it for 3 years. And in fact, on the spreadsheet, you can see that there is a transfer into the premium security account. That is on line 120. Yeah, 120. Thank you. There's a transfer into the premium security account. That is a transfer that is a result of the law that we passed last year. It's my understanding that due to changes in federal law and operation of the program, the estimates that we had for the cost of the program to operate for 3 years result in there being additional money in the program was necessary to operate for those 3 years, which is what the transfer out of the program that's proposed in the governor's budget and adopted in the DE is on line 121. We are not in the bill. There's no change to the statutory authorization of the program for 5 years. So the testimony we heard today about ending the program, I understand where it's coming from because of the money coming out of the program, but we're not changing the operational lifespan of the program by this bill statutorily. We're moving funding that's not necessary to operate for the amount that we authorized when we authorized the bill again last year. And I'm seeing confused faces, so I'm not sure if I did a good job explaining that. But Representative Dowd, I don't know if you wanted to.
Yeah, just on that same point. The intent here is to fund it for 5 years, and that no, the intent is what? To fund it for.
I would say the intent is to keep with the bill that passed last year, which funded the program for 3 years, but authorized it for five. There's more money in the premium security account than is necessary to operate the program beyond the third year, and we're removing that funding. But that's last year the legislature only put in enough money to operate it for 3 years, but we authorized it for five. And we're not repealing the authorization for 5 years or limiting it. We're just not allowing additional money to sit in the account beyond what's necessary to operate for 3 years. Representative Dowd.
So it looks like there's a transfer into it
correct.
In 24-25 for 229,465. And then a transfer out in 26-27 for 275,775.
That's right. And that first transfer was authorized by the reinsurance bill that we passed last year. When we passed reinsurance last year, we did some transfer immediately, but we put some transfer into the next biennium, which is the first biennium of this budget. Okay.
So
that transfer was the transfer you're seeing on line 120. Was authorized by the reinsurance bill that we passed last year and is not changed by the DE amendment. The transfer out in fiscal 26
sweeps the surplus
back out after 3 years of operation. So I would view this as a status quo provision as it pertains to reinsurance.
Okay. Is it possible to get a fiscal note on that or an accounting of that? Reinsurance.
We will think about how we can provide you with more information about that. I don't know if a fiscal note is the right tool, but we will think
whatever
about
it is. Yeah, thank you.
Do that. Anything? Okay. Yeah, so last thing, I will just say this again. We're not going to print new copies of the DE or the spreadsheet, so please leave them. Do not throw them out. And as a final reminder, amendments must keep the bill in balance. I will not allow consideration of amendment that throws the bill out of balance. With that, the committee is adjourned.